All right, delighted to be joined by Formula One legend Thierry Boutsen, a winner of 3 Grand Prix during his career, also raced at Le Mans, and also now working in the area of aviation. That's where I want to start off, actually, because I believe it's the fact that you studied engineering actually played a great role in bringing you into having that interest in planes and flight.
Well, there's a few things. I mean, I've always been passionate about what I'm doing, and car racing was one thing. I mean, actually, my parents always tell the story that I started my professional life when I was 3 years old because I told them that I wanted to become a Formula One driver. So that's when it all started. Unfortunately, I had to wait until I was 18 because in Belgium, you needed to have a driving license in order to be able to drive on racetracks. So that was the case. And and also at that time, my father accepted that I would that I would race cars, but he said to me that I need to study something, and engineering was the way to go. So I did mechanical engineering and started racing at about the same time when I was 18, 19, 20. And when I was 21 was my first, I would say, professional championship, and it was in Formula 3.
Yeah, and in terms of the business that you do now, I mean, you kind of started doing the acquisitions and sales even when you were racing.
Well, just at the end of my career. I mean, that's something that I started in 1997, and I raced until the end of 1999. So it was something that I started as a hobby again, or as a passion. I had no ambition to become an aircraft broker like I am now. It just happened to be like that. I mean, it came one deal after the other, and then enjoying that as much as I did enjoy racing in the past, I went full boost, I would say, in the year 2000. Employed one person, then two, then three, then four, and one by one we sold, until today we've sold 370 airplanes in 71 countries. So we are operating worldwide with a small team of 9 people in Monaco, plus 3 representatives, in one in Dubai, one in Moscow, and one in New Delhi. So the company has been doing very well since we started. We've been growing all the time, and I've enjoyed every moment of it.
Yeah, and maybe just to switch to how you got into Formula One. So this is towards the end of the 70s. You went through the junior formula. Can you just talk us through that pathway to get into Formula One in that era?
The first step into my professional career started when I was at university, actually, because as end of studies thesis, I decided to elaborate a racing engine. So I did all the calculation and build that engine following what I've had studied. And used that engine in my in 1978 was racing in Formula Ford, and I did 18 races that year and won 15 out of them, thanks to to my driving, of course, but also thanks to the engine that I built. And that really was the start of my career. If I had not studied engineering, I would never have gone into that that success, and that was the beginning, and that launched me into 2 years in Formula 3, 2 years in Formula 2. I did some endurance races as well, did some races in the World Championship in beginning of 1983, and got started at the Belgian Grand Prix with Arrows in 1983.
Yeah, and how was the, in terms of expense, because we know nowadays in Formula One, to get through all the pathways, there's a lot of money involved. How expensive was it in that era?
Well, the sponsorship that was needed to race a second car at Arrows was something around $500,000. And I didn't have the money to start with, but I promised Jackie Oliver that I would find it and bring it. And with his help and the help of the existing sponsors and the additional sponsors that I could bring, we managed to raise that amount of money. And he was happy and I was happy because I could drive the car. So it was about $500,000 in these days with, I don't know how much that would be today, but it's probably 5, 6, 7 million. I don't know. No idea.
Yeah. So before even getting into Formula One and before the Arrow seat, as you said, there's a few tests with Brabham and McLaren. Was there any point where you got close to moving to either of those teams?
No, it was the Marlboro test was organized by Marlboro just to, it was earlier. It was the wing car that I drove. it was just a reward to the people who had done very well in the past, and I was at that time driving in Formula 3, so I was actually, it was my third season in racing, so I was not exactly ready for that. But it was a good test, it was a good good moment, and I enjoyed it very much. Same with the Brabham, I had the chance to drive the car in Le Castellet, and it was my first really experience and touch into an F1 seat.
There was another point, I guess, I wanted to bring up with you, because obviously as a Belgian person, Spa-Francorchamps is obviously, it's one of those iconic racetracks behind, I guess, Monza, or around the same kind of level as Monza and Monaco. And you raced at the old 14-kilometer circuit.
I did, yes. It was totally crazy. I mean, this track was just so fast and so dangerous. My first endurance race I did there, 24 hours in 1977, I think, driving a VW Golf GTI. That was my first touch with endurance races. Then I drove a Toyota the year after in the 24 hours, but I mean, the car lasted less than 20 minutes, so I didn't have the chance to drive there. But it was really a legendary circuit at that time, and I'm glad I could do a few laps on that racetrack to get to know what the previous drivers have been doing in the past and the risks that they've been taking. Luckily, this circuit does not exist anymore. It's been transformed into something much, much safer, which is the actual Spa-Francorchamps racetrack. But it was quite an experience to drive at the old circuit, yeah.
Thierry, Leo here. You've brought us onto something quite interesting there, the safety issue. You drove in an iconic era against lots of big, big names and some cars that were quite raw and had a lot of power. And safety wasn't really as paramount as it is these days. Tell us a little bit about that. When you had those BMW engines, for example, in the Arrows, they were a little bit scary, surely.
Well, not only that. I mean, the Arrows was something really special. I mean, the car was weighing something like 550 kilos and... we had 1,200 horsepower, so you can imagine what it does. I mean, the power-to-weight ratio was just incredible. I remember driving it in Monaco with qualifying tires. I mean, it was just catapulting from one corner to the other. And going up the hill from San Diego to the casino, I had wheel spin until the fifth gear, you know, switching all the gears up, you know, second, third, fourth. I still had wheel spin in fifth gear going up the hill, so... You can imagine how difficult that was to control, to stay on this black bit of asphalt. It was fascinating to drive this. I mean, nobody will ever experience that anymore. I mean, the cars are much easier to drive these days. They've got full control, full electronic control. We didn't have any of that. And it was just the driver controlling the car with this, filling the car with his ass, I would say. And controlling the car with the steering wheel and the throttle pedal, which is no longer the case today, I must say.
No, absolutely. That engine that you spoke about there is probably one of the most iconic power plants, the BMW engine. And literally, drivers have said it was like an on-off switch. And as you said, the traction control was your right foot.
Absolutely. I mean, there was nothing else. I mean, we didn't have any electronics on the car. It was also mechanical injection, you know. So that was explaining why some of the engines blew up like crazy, and we've had some very spectacular blew ups on the engines there. It was a good time, and I learned a lot. And right after that, we got into something a little bit more civilized with the Ford engine, the V6 that I drove for Benetton, and then the normally aspirated engines again.
Yeah, interestingly, in 1984, you were swapping, I think, with your teammate, Mark Schurer. So at times, you'd be using the Cosworth engine and then obviously into the BMW, BMW turbocharged one. What kind of lay behind that decision-making, or was it kind of more of a team decision?
It was more, I would say, a developing factor. We had we had a few ideas on how to develop the car. I mean, getting from a Ford Cosworth with 500 horsepower into something with over 1,000 was not an easy task. And Dave was the engineer at that time, had absolutely no experience. So he had to build up some experience on that, and we had to learn. So Mark was driving, I was driving, and then sometimes we didn't have enough parts sometimes to be driving the two cars together. So we had it was kind of a learning exercise.
Yeah, and interestingly then, when 1985 comes around, that Arrows car, actually, there were, in terms of developments, you were able to finish second at San Marino, and there were other kind of interesting results as well. And I guess, what kind of lay behind the progress that was made at that point? Because the following year, it didn't really happen as well. I mean, there wasn't as much success in 86 as compared to 85.
85 was quite a good year for the Arrows team and for myself, yes. We didn't have much reliability. That was for sure one of the problems. But in 1986, everybody else had made big, big progress. And we were still using the same car, so that's why we were much, much behind the competition. So 1986 was probably a year that I would like to forget because it didn't bring us anything, didn't bring me anything. It was we had to be there, but without any hope to do well, because everybody had progressed so much between the two seasons.
Thierry, when you moved from Arrows, or moved on from anyone you'd driven to before, to Williams Grand Prix, what was the big difference? Were they more professional? Was it a nicer place to be?
Well, I moved to Benetton first.
Of course.
And, I mean, it was a very, very good team. Benetton Rory Byrne built a very nice car. 1987 car was fantastic to drive. Much more downforce than the Arrows that I drove before. And the engine was kind of unreliable to start with, but we managed to get some good results. I mean, I finished third in Adelaide, fifth in Japan, and I was leading the race in Mexico when I had an electrical problem. I remember some other races where the car was behaving very, very well, but Austria was another race where I could have won if I didn't have any a gearbox problem. So it was, for me, the first test of being close to the winning of a race, yeah.
And was Williams a step forward again from Benetton?
In terms of race team, yes. The engine was very, very good. The car was more reliable, but not as quick, not as competitive as the Benetton was probably the year before. Not as nice to drive also as the Benetton. Remember 1988, I finished with a Cosworth, with a normal aspirated engine. I finished six times on the rostrum and way ahead of everybody else in the normally aspirated category, and fourth in the championship. So that was my best season, actually, but I didn't win a race that year. With Williams, it was different. I mean, it was more up and down, up and down. Some races the car was behaving well, some races it was just very difficult, so...
Yeah, and interestingly, just on Benetton, actually, your teammate at the time was Teo Fabi, and it's always interesting to see how teammates interact. I know he wasn't particularly nice to you at one point, I think, where he was holding you up during a race, and you kind of spoke to him afterwards, and he said something probably not particularly nice, come back and see me when you've had a pole position, which is not a nice thing to say to anybody. Obviously, you did go on to finish third in that race in Australia, but it's funny how it can work out after Formula One. Like, I think you raced together with him in Le Mans at 1993, and I guess maybe relationships, once Formula One ends, people just seem to come together and there's a niceness then.
Sure, but I mean, this kind of reaction only lasts one race, you know. I've had talks like this with, and people have had talks with me like that after races when. When something goes wrong and you blame the other driver, I mean, it's happened to everybody, and it happens and will happen again. So, your teammate is your biggest competitor, in fact, and it's the only point of comparison that you have. So you need to handle that, and sometimes it's a little bit tough. But when he was in my way, I was just telling him, and when I was in his way, he was saying the same. But that's part of the game.
Yeah, and was it true actually as well, I think before, while the Williams negotiations were happening as well, there was a potential Ferrari were looking at teaming you up with Ayrton Senna as well for 88?
There was a talk about that, yes. And I met a few people from Ferrari when I was in Monaco, actually, during the race in Monaco. But it was all linked to Senna. I mean, the first move that had to happen was Senna to Ferrari. And that never happened. So I would have gone with Ayrton there, but he didn't go. So I had to go. I went to Williams instead.
Yeah, and obviously we're talking about pre-season testing at this time of year as well. 88 was quite interesting because McLaren at the time arrived late. Senna was in the team. Obviously, Prost was there as well. And then they just blew everyone away on that final day. Did you know exactly what you were up against then heading into that season? Because they dominated nearly every race.
Well, was that the year they won 15 out of 16?
Yeah, it was that year, yeah.
Yeah, so we were not quite in the same pace. I mean, I remember an ad saying that from McLaren that they put an ad in magazine saying that we won 15 out of the 16 races. Nobody is perfect.
I remember that.
Which is true, yeah. So
that, but we went, everybody else was in another league. I mean, that was domination with a big D.
Yeah, and that Senna-Prost rivalry, when you were kind of looking at it from afar, and I guess you were kind of the next best of the rest. Did you kind of ignore what was going on there, or was that kind of the talk of the paddock at the time?
No, but I mean, following that was very interesting too, and see what's going on in the front. But my goal was to beat them, and I didn't manage that very often, but I did a few times. So I was happy with that, but I must say in my career I was never in the best car at the right moment, so I couldn't compete with them.
Yeah, but you did have the three Grand Prix victories, and the first two particularly are quite interesting because they both happened in the wet. What kind of approach did you take generally in races where the conditions were like that?
Well, I always took that as an advantage for me because. When the car is not 100%, the driver in the wet can make a small difference to its advantage. And as I say, you know, when I joke about it, when you're a Belgian, you can practice every day on the road because it's raining every day. So that was a bit of an advantage. But I like driving in the wet. I mean, it's something that I've always looked for. And I won quite a few races in the wet, yeah.
Yeah, and particularly
when it was, I mean, pass in Formula 2, in Formula 3 as well, you know. It's something that I really liked it. And it was something that how should I say that? I mean, some people hate it, but it wasn't at all for me. I mean, I was hoping to have rained at every race.
Yeah, but there was the particular one, the Australian Grand Prix in 1989, which was your second race victory. And there was, I believe, before the race, you, Prost, and a lot of other drivers actually thought it was too dangerous to race.
Yes, everybody said that, but I said, no, I'm going to race.
And you went on to win.
I'm going to race. I mean, that's my chance.
Yeah.
My chance. The car was not the best car on the field, and... with the rain, I could make a difference, and I definitely wanted to race there, no matter what conditions we had, you know, and how good or bad they were. That was, for me, a big, big chance, and I took it and didn't make a mistake during the race, and I won the race.
Yeah, we mentioned Senna briefly earlier, and I know he was a very close friend of yours as well. How did that relationship begin in terms of the friendship?
It began... Well, first of all, the first time I really met Ayrton was in Detroit. We raced together. I mean, we were in the same, of course, we raced in the same race, but we had a big, big moment for 25 laps together. He was passing me, I was passing him, and we had really a nice racing event there on our own because we were at the back of the field. And then I had to retire with some mechanical problems. And then I remember we were in Mexico and we went to Japan or something like that. And we all made a stop, or was it somewhere else? I don't know. We all made a stop in Mauritius for a few days off between two races. And we happened to be at the same hotel at the same time. And he was driving at Lotus, I think, at the time. That was his second year or third year. And it was 1985, I think. And now we met there and we started a kind of a friends. We started being friends over there.
Yeah.
That relationship kept on going all the time, and then until the accident, actually. And I just a few days before the accident, I've asked him to be the godfather of my son that was to be born at about that time. And he accepted it. And unfortunately, he died a few days before my son was born.
Yeah, actually, in fact, you were there as one of the pallbearers as well at the funeral. And I think it's where I think people, because it was almost like a 3 days of mourning for the people of Brazil. I think it's where people realized just what an impact he'd made as a racer and as an iconic figure within sport.
But all over Brazil, I mean, he would have been good enough to become president of Brazil, you know, without any hesitation. If he had gone for it, he would have been elected immediately.
Mm.
I'm sure. I mean, he was just so popular and bringing so many positive influences to Brazil that he was second to God, I think.
Yeah, and God
in
was
Brazil for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously God was a big part of his life and religion as well. But one of the things I think people maybe don't realize about him, he had a sense of humor, because obviously we don't always see all this stuff behind the scenes. But I was looking at a video. I think it was your birthday in 1993. You're in the Jordan garage with Barrichello, who was your teammate at the time. Ayrton Senna is there. Obviously, the cake is made in the shape of your helmet, and Senna's there with a glass of water. I presume because you're laughing, you know exactly what he did to you.
No, absolutely. No. But we had some good times together.
Yeah.
And there were two Senna's. There was one Senna on the track and one Senna outside the track. And we spent quite a few. I mean, every time we had a chance to spend some days off or holidays or go somewhere together, we did. And it was really enjoyable. And sometimes we were flying together to the racetrack. I mean, I had an airplane at that time, a Learjet here based in where I was living here in Monaco, and he was there. So we were flying to the races together with my jet. So we spent a lot of time together. I had enormous respect for him, for what he's done. And he was, of course, much better than me, much faster than me, and more intelligent than me. But we were good friends.
Yeah. One thing I was actually curious about was the exit from Williams, because your teammate Nannini was kept on. Patrese was kept on, whereas you had won three Grand Prix to one Grand Prix that he had won. Were you kind of disappointed maybe that decision was made? Because again, winning races is obviously the biggest currency you can have in the sport.
Yes, but you know, it was like that. I mean, Frank was looking for sponsors, and I had a very, very... Well, I didn't have any sponsors. I mean, I was paid to drive. I didn't have any sponsors behind me. And when Labatt decided to come in to sponsor the team, they definitely wanted to have Nigel. So he went for Nigel. And I think Frank decided to keep Ricardo for whatever reason. I mean, that was his decision. Patrick was maybe more kind to have me in the team than Ricardo, but Frank was the decider. So Ricardo stayed there.
Mm. And as I mentioned as well, obviously Senna's little prank during your birthday took place in the Jordan garage. That was in the last season of your career in 1993. Eddie Jordan, of course, is from here in Ireland, so we know him quite well. How did you find him as a team principal to deal with? Your laugh is telling me there's a story coming.
No, Eddie is an incredible guy, really incredible. What he has achieved in his life is just unreal. I drove for him at a time where the car was not very good. The car was actually far too small. It was built around Barrichello, which was probably 1 meter shorter than me. So I could not fit in the car. I could not drive the car. I mean, I could not turn the steering wheel. I had to. I mean, my arms were too big. My legs were too big. It was a nightmare for me. And it got to a point where it was dangerous. I mean, driving on race track like on fast places like Spa and all that was extremely, extremely dangerous. So instead of risking my life and having a big accident there, I decided to stop and go racing in endurance.
Thierry, when you we all know the stories about Eddie Jordan being a wheeler dealer and contra deals and swaps and last minute deals, especially 1992, for example, he had a lot of drivers in the car. How did you end up? How was the deal done for you to end up with Jordan in 1993?
Well, believe it or not, he paid me to drive.
Really?
But sure, not much, but he paid me to drive. And when I retired, he gave me he gave me the car that that I drove with as my last Formula One car as a present to me. No, I had a lot of respect for Eddie Dillmann. He had his own way of doing things, and very clever businessman, very good driver he was as well, very good organizer. He's been successful in everything that he's done. So I have a lot of respect for him.
Do you still have the car?
The car is owned by the Prince Albert in his collection. The car is in his collection.
Excellent.
Mm. It's still in Monaco. You can see it whenever you want.
Thierry, if we move forward a little bit, some people move away and retire from motor racing and they just don't have any interest. Other people are always around as pundits, as commentators. You can hear in your voice that you're still quite excited and there's emotion when you speak about some of the times. Did you watch testing last week? Will you watch the Australian Grand Prix this weekend?
Is it this weekend? I didn't even know.
You still keep in touch?
Yes, I do, but I'm far away from all that. I watch the races on television, yes, sure. And I come to the Monaco Grand Prix because it's home, but otherwise, I mean, I've spent 23 years working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in motorsport, and I decided to stop to do something else, and I'm very happy with what I'm doing at the moment. So Formula One is now kind of a hobby for me, and I like watching it, but I don't have this drug anymore that I need to be there just to see what's going on. Like many others. I mean, I'm doing something else and I'm very happy with my life.
You've been cured.
Oh, yeah. In a way.
Okay. What do you think about Hamilton, Vettel? Who do you think will get it this year? Who's going to win the championship?
Oh, we need a change, huh?
Yeah, really.
We need a big change. Yeah. And I hope Vettel can. If he doesn't make as many mistakes as last year, he's going to win it. Otherwise his teammate's going to win.
You think Charlotte Leclerc can challenge Vettel?
I'd be surprised. Yeah. You'd be surprised, yeah. He's very, very good.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, I rate him very, very high. Still has a lot to learn, but when you see what he's done with the Alfa Romeo last year, chapeau.
One thing, actually, I did want to ask you about, actually, because I was watching an interview you did with a magazine, I think Hello, in Monaco, and you spoke about two life-changing moments in your life. So one of them was meeting your wife. The other, actually, was an accident at Le Mans in 1999. Can you just tell us about maybe that second one and how and why it had such a profound effect on you?
I had the accident in Le Mans. It was, I mean, I've been extremely lucky that I was very, very fit at the time. I'm still very, I'm probably fitter now than what I was then, but being very, very fit saved my life because I had lots of fractures on my body. I mean, the spine was broken, the vertebrae were broken. I was paralyzed. I had no feelings in the legs. I could not move my legs anymore when I had the accident. And it took me about, 4 years to recover from that accident. The first 2 years, I was living on painkillers every day. After 2 years, I could get rid of that. But I started to live normally again, be able to walk and do some sports and starting doing some proper training, not only just to recover, but to improve my condition after 4 years. So during these 4 years, I mean, they've been hard for me. It has been a tough time. But I succeeded, and I was very, very strong in my head so that there was nothing that would have stopped me from improving my health and my physical condition. But it was tough. It was really tough, and you know, I had to learn to walk again because being without feeling in your legs for some time, it all came back after the operation. It all came back to normal feelings again. But it took me some time to be able to walk again. I had two 8 hours operation on the back and on the vertebrae and on the spine in order to relight the fire in my legs. So it was pretty, pretty tough.
Yeah, and when things like that happen, does it kind of change how you view motorsport and, I guess, the danger around it?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think I wouldn't like to... Well, I must say that, it's about 20 years after that. But when that happened, I was really, right after the accident, 1 or 2 years after the accident, I was scared of a lot of things, you know, very, very scared driving cars, even on the road, because the pain was just so high, and the my physical condition was just so diminished that I was scared of being hurt again and making it worse. But when days pass and the condition is improving, you tend to forget the bad things and only remember the good things. So there are even days where I don't think about the accident anymore.
Mm. Well, thanks a million anyway for taking the time to chat to us. It's been fascinating actually getting your insights and memories of Formula One, of, I'd say, your era. Actually, I think most people would agree, probably the strongest of all, one of the strongest driver lineups. So it was brilliant to chat to you, and best of luck with Bootson Aviation as well.
Thank you very, very much. It was nice talking to you, and thank you for the good questions. And it was really, really, really nice to refresh my memory about some of the things that
yeah, it's
that
funny
I don't talk about every day.
Yeah, it's easy to forget how long time passes as well, I think, is the thing.
Yeah.